So somebody, Luke 4, read verses 14 through 30, and then afterwards I'll say the word of the Lord, and we say thanks be to God. Luke 4, who's got that? Thanks be to God. Is that a fabulous Christmas text or what? Jesus walks in the temple, everybody's, yeah, Spirit of the Lord, this guy's great. And then they're ready to throw him off a cliff. Bracing failure. Parker Palmer says this, should have remembered from my own experience that students too are afraid of failing, of not understanding, of being drawn into issues they would rather avoid, of having their ignorance exposed or their prejudices challenged, of looking foolish in front of their peers. When my students' fears mix with mine, fear multiplies geometrically and education is paralyzed. Psychology notes for us that there are two standard dreams that people tend to have that follow the same plot. So picture men and women who have families and are well off into a successful career. They will still often have anxiety about school. So there is the one where you're standing in front of the classroom or in the hallway in your underwear, trying to cover yourself and trying to find a corner to hide in, and no one's seeming to notice. The other one is that you are about to sit down and take an exam for a course, and you suddenly realize as you look down that you never attended the class. One of those seems to be about social expectations and all the pressures of adolescence, insecurities about our appearance, our peers' constant obsession with how they look, cruel comments about people's clothes or hair or face or body as we walk the halls. Who in here, I always tell my boys when they're struggling with junior high, is there anybody on planet Earth that wants to go back to junior high? I mean, remember that? It's kind of like running the gauntlet almost. John lives in perpetual junior high, but no one, I mean, that was running the gauntlet. The other dream is about the institutional layer of school, so teachers and quizzes and red ink and the dreaded standardized testing. Most of us at an early age fall short of expectations. Our parents, our grandparents, siblings, other adults in our life. And school, if that doesn't happen, quickly immerses you in a world of systematic and formal deadlines and evaluations and expectations. And so then there's disappointments. And school is about measuring success. So if you're in a great home and background and extended family and you don't get that early as a child, then school quickly puts you there and documents your weaknesses and your failures. And that sense of falling short can be with students who are getting straight A's and students who are barely passing. But long before school ever records it, children know that they have been measured and found wanting. They know that their parents are disappointed with them. They know that their parents think that they're lazy. They know that the neighbor kid was able to ride his bike at 5. They know that that family member, that cousin who is really athletic and the short, chunky child secretly knows they will never be that. And that doesn't even include the words from neighborhood kids, from our peers in school, extended family, coaches, and so on. And the cumulative message is in that some way we fail to measure. Now, most of us, we hate to fail. We don't want to, but we do. And I would say to you tonight that failure isn't actually a sin. You know, we hear the word mistake or failure, and we think sin. There was a pastor that his church had printed in the bulletin the liturgical prayer that said, Lord, please forgive our sins, our mistakes, and our failures. And he thought to himself, confessing sin, that makes sense, our turning away from God, our turning away from our neighbor, our anger, our pride, our envy, our sloth, that has a way of harming people and breaking relationships. But do mistakes and failures always equal sin? You know, I suppose tonight that failing to obey God or failing to help your neighbor who is in trouble is sin. But we make mistakes, and sometimes they're that. They're mistakes. We didn't know. They're unintentional. And failure can just be my inability to perform certain tasks, like parallel parking. You know? The simplest definition of failure is to fall short of expectations. Expectations could be yours, could be other people's expectations, could be work, these standards that are put above us. We talk about expectations here. Expectations aren't all bad. We're in this period of time called Advent, where we're waiting. We're identifying with this great tradition of Israel that waited for a Messiah. The Messiah has come. We participate in that. But we're waiting for the fullness of his kingdom. And so we're trying to slow down in the midst of chaos and be quiet and allow Christ to be born again in us. So Advent, in living Advent, really is about living expectantly. Expectations aren't all bad. They pull us forward. They cause us to dream, to imagine different things, a better life for ourselves or for our children. Expectations can give us hope. So to live expectantly is to be human. But to live expectantly and to have expectation means that we fail. And to fail is not always a sin. Who's got Matthew 13? One more passage. Matthew 13, verses 53 through 58. So just five verses. Use your British accent.
Yeah, right. When Jesus had finished these parables, he left that place. He came to his hometown and began to teach the people in their synagogue, so that they were astounded and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these deeds of power? Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all this?" And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "Prophets are not without honor except in their own country and in their own house." And he did not do many deeds of power there because of their unbelief.
Another great, fantastic Christmas text that we come to. Did Jesus fail? Are we allowed to ask that question? I think I put that in the email. I mean, certainly Jesus failed to live up to his own expectations and desires. He was a finite, embodied person, as we talked about last week. He attempted to share the good news, the gospel of the kingdom, with his family and his neighbors in Nazareth and to fellow Jews in Jerusalem. He wanted them to understand that the appointed time, the Messiah was here. And we're told at one point that his family came for him thinking he had gone off the deep end and they had come to take him home, if necessary, by force. Holding straitjacket in their hand is what you're to picture. Even his mother, who knew his unique calling, obviously because of the miraculous revelation in her own body, could not always grasp who Jesus was and what this meant, and it seems that Jesus failed in helping her to fully understand. He performed great miracles through Galilee and Judea, but he could not do the same in his hometown because of their unbelief. It seems like the people close to him, rather than trying to understand him, they just kind of explained him away. And all this was even more evident at the heart of the Jewish system, the Jewish world in Jerusalem. Jesus said, "O Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones God's messengers, how often have I wanted to gather your children together as a hen protects her chicks beneath her wings, but you wouldn't let me." See that Jesus tenderly, compassionately describing what he longs to do and yet freely admits he fails to fulfill that longing. He could teach, he could heal, he could befriend, but he couldn't do that for all people, no matter how deeply he wanted to or no matter how much he loved them. And I think that was a source of frustration. You can hear sometimes the current underneath things. You can hear his frustration in responses like, "Did you not know that I would be in my Father's house?" We try to always say, "Oh, Jesus is being respectful." Yeah, but there's some intensity. Did you not know that I should be about my father's business? Remember at the wedding of Canaan, woman, why do you involve me? My time has not yet come. You can hear it when Mary and the brothers are standing at the edge of the crowd and the crowd tells Jesus, hey, your family's here, Jesus. It's time to go. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother. You can hear it when Peter is looking at him and walking on the top of the water. And Jesus says, you of little faith. You can hear it when he walks over to a sleeping Peter, James, and John in the garden and says, could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Jesus lived an Advent, living expectantly for his disciples, and they would eventually do greater things than him, but in the meantime, they frustrated his expectations. There was a sense that he failed in some ways in his expectations for them. Jesus failed to fulfill his own expectations for others, and then he quickly discovered that he was not in control of the responses of other people. Imagine sitting in a crowd and God incarnate is in front of you, declaring to you kingdom life and kingdom freedom, and you walk away. Imagine being an eyewitness to one of the miracles, and you walk away. Think of the Jewish leaders who totally miss the point and are angered that Jesus is doing miracles on the Sabbath. Think of the rich young ruler, eye to eye with Jesus, Jesus calling him to be his disciple and follow him, and he turns his back and walks away. The disciples have to be the most frustrated. They look really colorful and pretty there. Not so much. I tried to clean them up a little bit. I mean, they walked with him, think of this, daily for 3 years, heard his teaching over and over again, witnessed more miraculous deeds than anybody, and having seen him multiply fish and loaves to feed 5,000 people, they wondered if he could do it again for 4,000 people. Imagine Jesus, what's going on in his head? Seriously? Seriously? 5,000? Loaves, fish, 4,000? Seriously? Guys, come on. They constantly vied for his attention in the now, and then they argued with each other over who would be great in the future kingdom. Imagine Jesus sitting in that conversation. Seriously? I'm here. You know? Pours love into crazy Peter, who always has this ability to open his mouth at the wrong time, and Peter denies him at the most crucial moment of his life. All of the disciples fled and hid after his arrest. Judas, who he poured himself into, is so overwhelmed by his guilt that instead of it leading to repentance, it led him to hang himself. See, it reminds you tonight that God didn't rig this thing for Jesus. Like, Jesus didn't show up and people would just kind of robotically do his bidding. Like, the world wasn't programmed to somehow fulfill Jesus' expectations. He could not control how other people responded, just like we can't. And here's why, because love doesn't force itself. Part of truly loving the other is to expect and then to also accept that they will fail to respond like we would like them to. Jesus knows this, he willingly enters into that, and he experiences all that. And then on top of that, the disciples turn around and they're disappointed in Jesus. You seriously are going, really? They're disappointed in Jesus, and people all over are disappointed in Jesus because they had expectations of what he would look like, of what he would be, how he would do it, what he would say. I mean, a dramatic example of this is John the Baptist. He finds himself in prison, and he sends one of the disciples to ask Jesus, are you the one, or should we expect somebody else? And I know you said something about this, but really? I mean, John's expectations of Jesus are really, hey, probably you should protect me from the reach of Herod's prison. Or even that, you know, Jesus would protect him at least from the Roman Empire, but later he is beheaded. But really, John's expectations of, Jesus are not that much different than Jesus' own mother or close friends or Mary, Martha, and Lazarus or a number of the 12 or the Pharisees. Most of them had expectations that he would save through judgment, not suffering. The fact of the matter is most people, and we want to be saved by a conquering king, not redeemed by a suffering servant. And he frustrated everybody, and it reminds me of Shakespeare, expectation is the root of all heartache. Apply that by affinity when we're talking about Jesus. Now, hopefully you felt a little weird to think, during this time of Advent, so this time to slow down, to prepare our hearts for Christ to be born anew in us and to re-celebrate, to be recharged about this idea of divinity and humanity coming together in the incarnation and Jesus being united to all of us and saving us, and we want to re-celebrate that. And here we are in Advent, and it's a little bit strange, right, to say that Jesus teaches us how to fail. I would say like a pro. He teaches us how to fail gracefully and without sin. But if you and I are going to live fully human lives, if we're going to live Advent, not just talk about it, if we're going to live Advent, which means be full of hope and full of expectancy, as Advent would teach us, then we have to learn to fail, and Jesus teaches us how to. In the most basic sense, that he does not allow his limits as a finite human being, picture that, in a world of limitless needs. He does not allow, that doesn't retain his love or compassion. He was able to be there and do it well and be in the moment and give people his love and compassion. Jesus knew that there was more good work to accomplish in this world than any one person could even possibly attempt. But he accepted and he faced his limits as a human being, and he did what he could do, and he did it in 24-hour periods, and he did it well, and he focused. Most of us come face to face with the limits in life and our failures, and what happens is we learn over time to lower our expectations, to curb our hopes, to abandon our dreams, and we become cynics, and we say, you know, what is the point? So much need in the world. What difference is this money? What made serving this group? What difference is that going to make? Jesus faced the limits, fully well knowing that he would eventually turn his face towards Jerusalem and accomplish an infinite act for everyone. But he faced his limits, and he did it well. He focused on what he could do. Think of it. He poured himself into 12 goofy individuals. And yet inspired, encouraged them, and foretold that where I leave off, you will take the mantle and move forward, and you will, how about this, do greater things than me. Think of that. All the way to the ends of the earth. In the face of sin and sickness and hunger and rejection, he preached and he healed and he walked and he talked with people and he encouraged and he confronted them. He did what he could do in the time that he had. And then in other moments, he withdrew into lonely places to pray and to rest. And imagine those moments there in a very mysterious, intimate conversation with his father. He unburdened himself. And with his father, he accepted his inability to minister to everyone, to be all things to all people. And then he was able to rise up from those lonely places and go out and do what he could do with a fresh passion. And what happened? The disciples pick up the mantle. They finish what was left off. Jesus blessed them to go and do more than even he could do. Some of you have seen this, but it's worth looking at. Reminds me of this prayer, Oscar Romero. It helps now and then to step back and take a long view. The kingdom is not only beyond your efforts, it's beyond your vision. You accomplish in your lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing you do is complete, which is a way of saying that the kingdom always lies beyond us. No statement says all that could be said. No prayer fully expresses our faith. No confession brings perfection. No pastoral visit brings wholeness, except here. No program accomplishes the church's mission. No set of goals or objectives includes everything. And this is what we are about. We plant seeds that one day will grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces far beyond our capabilities. We cannot do everything, and there is a sense of liberation in realizing that. This enables us to do something and to do it very well. It will be incomplete, but it is a beginning, a step along the way, an opportunity for the Lord's grace to rush in and do the rest. We may never see the end results, but that is the difference between the master builder and a worker. We are workers, not master builders. We are ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future, not our own. Jesus encountered that. Jesus felt that. Jesus planted seeds, watered seeds, laid foundations that others would add to. Jesus always seemed to be able to find the road between better and best. We fail to touch everything that needs to be touched. So where is it that we can best invest? Where has God called us? Where has he gifted and wired us? Where is it that we can really pour our time and energy and then let it be? And then even in that, to fail gracefully. We talked about James Fowler last week. James Fowler talks about all of us understanding our giftedness, to know where are you wired? What really charges your jets? Figure out where God has really made you and designed you in this way, but then also know that that ends. There are limits to that. And when you do, you enter this arena, what he would call an ecology of giftedness. This world where you are both a giver and a receiver. You use your gifts to bless, but then other people come along and fill up what is lacking. And he says, what that does, when you understand that, it helps you from being too inflated with this kind of God consciousness, and it keeps you from being too deflated when you fail. So his big point in one of his books is that the key for all of us to accepting our limits is to understand God's specific calling on our lives. How's God wired you? How do you see the world? What is it that you contribute? What he would probably refer to as vocation. Because in knowing how God has gifted us and exactly where he's called us to use those gifts, here's a direct quote. He says, we're freed to seek a responsible balance in the investment of our time and energy, which is the opposite of workaholism. So if you're a workaholic, you have to pull back and look and go, are you really doing what God has gifted you to do? And then he says this, we're also freed from the sense of having to be all things to all people because God has also gifted and called others to do his good work in the world. There's a time where you step back and receive. You can't do everything. You can't do everything well. You can't be all things to all people, and that's what it means to be human, and that's good. Jesus' experience of that. That sense of freedom is very evident in Jesus' life when he tells the disciples that the Holy Spirit will come upon them and they will be witnesses for him. And then he actually said, you will do greater things than me. Meaning you'll be in more places and at more times sharing the gospel with more people, and people that didn't hear me will suddenly hear you. And then I would add that generations of faithful Christians that follow the disciples will succeed where they failed, where they left off. And that's how it is. That's how it works. It gets back to what we said last week of this primal temptation. At the heart of man, we are a creature, and one of our primal temptations is to play God, to sit where we don't belong. Mankind is the one creature that really lusts to ascend to God's place, to situate ourselves in the control room and to put ourselves at the helm of the world. I always picture we're like little kids in daddy's workshop and we've busted in and we've plugged in the power saw, and no matter how much we pretend to know that we are doing, we're in big trouble. But to be God, friends, means the death of humanity. Jesus came so that you would see divinity and humanity united. He came so that you would participate and share, be partakers of the divine nature. He says humanity is good, so when we try to ascend to something that we are not and break that creator-creature distinction, then we lose humanity. This is really key, so follow me here. Part of growing up to maturity, I would say part of being fully human, part of spirituality and following the path of Jesus is accepting responsibility. We all know, and maybe we struggle with this, there's a lot of people that don't accept the past, that don't accept responsibility. I know people all the time that make these decisions, and I kind of look and go, what did you, like, you made that decision, and that might be a really good decision, but every decision has consequences. Own them. So part of spiritual maturity and being fully human is owning, accepting responsibility. And then here's the weird paradox. As you keep growing, as you keep maturing, as you go and blossom into full humanity, you must also accept limits on your responsibility. Here's what I mean. So here's the paradox. When we're kids, our parents have to give us responsibility. So maybe some of us had to clean our room or at least make a path so that people could walk in them or feed the goldfish or mow the lawn. We were nagged about our homework, and then there was parent-teacher conferences to make sure that all that was working. And we grow older, and maybe we have to pay for the gas or the insurance on our first car. But our parents are instilling in us this responsibility. After years of learning responsibility, after being part of a family unit and having others depend upon us, like our decisions have consequences for them, after being at the center of our world and feeling so necessary, you now have to face a new reality that there are limits on your responsibility. This is part of maturing. No matter how willingly you assume the problems of the world, no matter how effectively, and I know people that can solve the world's problems, no matter how effectively you might be able to solve them, you quickly discover in life that there is only so much that one person can do, and it is usually a lot less than you imagine. So to maintain this trajectory, to move along this path, to really mature, to grow into spiritual adulthood, hear this, we have to let go of responsibility as completely as we had to accept it in the first place. There's one of those fun paradoxes in life. Be responsible. Okay, now there's limits on your responsibility. You see that? That's important, though. Now, that doesn't mean we become irresponsible and somehow shirk our duties, but it means we accept and we own that we're fallible, that we're finite, and that other people make decisions and we can't control that, and so we have to acquiesce to the limitations of what we can do. And can I tell you, this is not easy for multiple reasons, but for at least two. First off, being needed feels good. You know, responsibility can be a burden. It can be a heavy burden that causes you to be lonely and in isolation, but responsibility can also give you a boost of self-importance, a boost of self-worth. This is what I mean about we have to watch out for this kind of what one author calls God lust. I sound like two words there, but it's God lust. Just wanted you to hear it. God lust. We like being in God's place, situated comfortably in the center of our universe of our own making. And when you sit on that throne, it's not appropriate for you, so you feel a little funky about it, and pretty soon there's this agitation, and you can kind of sedate that agitation. You can give it a quick fix by others depending upon you. You see this? If my wife needs me, if my children depend upon me, if my friends need my input, counsel, and influence, If my employer considers me indispensable, if my parents in their old age look at me as I looked at them when I was a child, if I am needed for the well-being of others, then I am important and I deserve my place at the center of the world. The other thing that it's hard to see limits on our responsibility, because those usually depending upon us are those the ones that we love the most. In other words, the ones that we're truly bound to, family and friends. So a lot of times this isn't just this. A lot of times this is deeper than ego. It springs from our heart. Like we want to swoop in and be someone's angel or their savior. You know, true affection for people will mobilize all of our forces, and we're going to jump in and we're going to provide help. We feel the need to save those that we love and to rescue them when they're in deep trouble. We have to be the one, that angel, who pulls them out of the pit when they have fallen. And the fact of the matter is that often our arms are too short to reach people. The fact is, hear this, there are things that we cannot fix, and when we try, we make them worse. There are things that you cannot fix, and when you interject yourself, you make it worse. And there are problems that you can fix, that you can input yourself, and there are people that you can help so far as you are able, but the key phrase there is so far as we are able. The little secret that none of us like to admit is that none of us are God, not really when it gets down to it and someone needs saving. And even if we were God, we would have to contend with this one pesky issue, human freedom. You see, I mean, Jesus is showing that. Like, so even if you're God, there is, remember in the Jim Carrey movie, Bruce Almighty, Jim Carrey looks at God and goes, how do you make someone love you? And God kind of goes, yeah, there you go. You've hit it. So there's this pesky issue of human freedom. What makes free will a real issue is that people have it. And they are under the impression that they have the right to exercise it. That's what makes free will a problem. It creates difficulties. Look at the history of mankind. But God apparently values human freedom enough to withdraw his sovereignty to make room for it. And we have to do the same. I like to interject humor because humor makes you like a little child. And I'm being vulnerable here. I'm putting myself out here because this might not be funny to some of you. But I found this image and it just made me laugh thinking about determinism and free will. Trapped between quantic indeterminacy and guilt regarding the deterministic effects his choice would lead to, the considerate photon just stopped in its tracks. Okay, a few of you get it. That's my kind of humor right there. Have you ever met a considerate photon? But that's the struggle that we're dealing with human freedom, that even if we're God, there is this pesky thing known as human freedom. This really touched me. Frederick Buchner, in his memoir, speaks of his daughter's anorexia and the anguish that he felt inside watching her pretty much starve to death. And he said this, "The only way I knew to be a father was to take care of her, as my father had been unable to take care of me, to move heaven and earth if necessary to make her well, and of course, I couldn't do that. I didn't have either the wisdom or the power to make her well. None of us have the power to change other human beings like that, and it would be a terrible power if we did, the power to violate the humanity of others even for their own good. The psychiatrist we consulted told me I couldn't cure her. The best thing I could do for her was to stop trying to do anything. I think in my heart I knew they were right, but it didn't stop the madness of my desperate meddling. It didn't stop the madness of my trying. Everything I could think to do or say only stiffened her resolve to be free from, among other things, me. Her not eating, misspelling there, was a symbolic way of striking out for that freedom. The only way she would ever be well again was if and when she freely chose to be. The best I could do as her father was to stand back and to give her that freedom, even at the risk of her using it to choose for death instead of life. The best we can sometimes do is to stand back and respect the freedom of others. Sometimes a wife will have to stop making excuses for her husband's bad decisions. Sometimes a father will have to stop lecturing his druggy son and providing him a place in the home and bailing him out of jail. An employee will have to walk away from work to sometime attend to the needs of the family, no matter how much the boss rants and raves. A husband may have to resign from the impossible task of guaranteeing his wife's happiness, realizing that no human being can do that for another. A daughter may have to give up trying to make her parents understand why she decided on a career that will give little opportunity for marriage or family. Sometimes it's no longer your responsibility, if it ever was. We cannot change the past. We cannot control the reaction of other people. And we cannot fix everything that is broken. If the past has painful parts to it, that is space enough for God to intervene and bring healing. If somebody is angry with you, then they're going to have to stay angry or eventually forgive you. If things are still broken, life carries on sometimes in the midst of broken fragments. A question for you during this Advent season is this: is there somebody that you're trying to control? Are you trying to get them to change or to do something? Is there a family member that you're trying to figure them out? Because part of maturity, part of spiritual growth, part of being fully human, and especially to enter into what we would call Christian spirituality, is this death and resurrection. Of learning to say to God, God, I give you this person, this event in my life with all of its frustrating complexity. I've tried to be in the driver's seat. I've tried to figure them out so I could control them, and it hasn't worked. I want them to go right, and they go left. And so I live with this frustration of that their heart won't seemingly do what it's supposed to do. And so we gather all that, and we bring it to the cross because the world never works the way that we expect it. It doesn't care what labels that we make for it. It always extends itself beyond those. Good guys aren't always good. Bad guys aren't always bad. The Bible teaches us the human heart is an enigma. Your heart is a mystery as well. Why do you do what you do? And we have to gather all that and give it over to God and die to that. And here we are. I mean, remember when we did the story of Jonah? Jonah flees from God and runs possibly as far away from him as he could get. And what does he do? He encounters God face to face there. In the despair and in the darkness, we gather up all of our labels and our easy answers and the tension and the anxiety and the smallness of ourselves and our lack of ability to deal with things. And we bring it to this God of Advent and we wait and we realize that he is coming. That he is doing something. And we let our trust and our confidence be in that. Last two things for you to consider with this idea of Jesus failing to meet other people's expectations, sometimes failing to live up to his own expectations. A reminder tonight that there is a gift in these. So last week we talked about weakness in need, and that is fully human, and our American culture fights against that. It says, you know, stiff upper lip, just make it, don't rely on others. And God's actually built it in such a way that you have to rely on others. So that weakness and need, Jesus knows. Lack of knowledge, Jesus knows. And he calls you to enter into those and to accept them. And that is part of being fully human. And then Jesus, I think tonight, says to us, there is only so much that we can do. And it's sometimes not easy to accept that. But there are gifts, there are consolations, there are graces when we accept our limits. See, there's life in the limitations. Those limitations can become sacraments where God is revealed to us and our faith deepens and our trust in others is better. because that we accepted these things. The first gift that I see with realizing we fail to live up to other people's expectations, we fail to control other people, we don't live up to our expectations, I think the first is the joy of giving. When you honor the limitations of your responsibility, you give other people a precious freedom, the freedom to live their own lives for better or for worse. You release them. That includes the freedom to find their own way through some of the difficulties that they make, and maybe that's the route that they need to take for authentic healing and growth. Maybe they have to learn it that way. So in accepting the limitations of our humanity, what you're often doing is you're making room for somebody else to take responsibility, where you would want to remove that. You would want to control the situation. People need to be able to select their own rowboats and pull their own oars. And if the boat begins to sink into the water, the one rowing has to decide, are we going to fix it? Are we going to tread water? Are we going to jump ship and swim to the shore? Friends, sometimes though we have, and I do this, and you've told me stories about you doing this, some of you. Sometimes we have this inflated sense of responsibility, and we don't allow that. And those under our care, or those who we are friends with or family members, they either remain, and don't we know people, they either remain passively dependent on us, or they become aggressively independent. And they break away from our influence. Think of this with parents and child. There are few things that are more pathetic than an individual who, out of excessive dependency, is just like paralyzed, like comfortably numb. They just constantly need approval and pat on the back. Unless perhaps worse than that is the individual who, out of excessive independence, ruthlessly acts out and ignores other people in the pursuit of their own selfish desires. See, friends, to help others avoid those extremes is like to help them to become strong and sensitive, assertive and considerate, which means sometimes we have to draw back and let them succeed or let them fail on their own. We stay connected to them. We offer truth-telling when it is invited, and there's understanding and there's always support in the background, but sometimes we let it be. We were talking about babies tonight and their first steps. My wife loves baby toes, so I had to put that up there. I still remember, and those of you that have kids, I vividly remember their first steps, where it's amazing to watch this creature that's been so dependent upon you to realize they can stand and that they can put one foot in another and keep walking. And that's really exhilarating and also stinking scary at the same time. Because you know what comes after that, they don't stop. They start and then they don't stop. But then there's also the idea of when they get near the glass coffee table. So you know parents that there's some parents, you know, by the second, third child, it's like they've got so many bumps and bruises because you just don't care anymore. But the first child is kind of like, they're always walking on eggshells because they're protecting. They don't want them to fall and get hurt. And it's this gradual process. They walk, and then pretty soon they're on hard garage floors and cement, and you're always on these eggshells. And if we deserve any credit for parenting, it's not only the things that we do right, but sometimes it's having the sense not to do those things that felt so right. Not always to jump in. To allow others to mature, we have to let them discover their own sense of responsibility, and that sometimes means surrendering ours. That's difficult. But when you do, see, that's freedom for others. That's the gift. So the limitation in this is you can't control other people, and that's freeing for others because you sometimes let them be and figure it out for themselves. But it's also freeing for you. So as difficult as it is to let go of the reins sometimes, it also can be a relief. Because to feel responsible for everything, you either have to be God or expect to go nuts. I mean, if you're here tonight and you think that you're God, we've got people here to help you afterwards. And if you know that you're not God, but you still want to be responsible for everything, you have to take Advent to stop and slow down and realize how utterly impossible and stupid that is. Because you will need help before long as well. No one except God can carry the weight of everyone's safety, health, happiness, and fulfillment in life. As vivid as my memories are of children's first steps, there's one that I remember also, that feeling, that helpless feeling of bad things can happen to them. I remember feeling that one day in particular where I let my mind, why do we do that? Let my mind wander down the road of possible disasters that could overtake them. And it was like, I mean, it's like acid in your insides when you think about a loved one and like, oh, what could happen? And I remember bringing Spencer home from the hospital and thinking, I am responsible for him. Thank God Carrie was there, but I am also responsible for him. And that burden, you know that as parents, that burden is a heavy burden. I remember two things. I remember looking, because for women, it's like growing inside them. It's a part of them. And I think sometimes men are kind of separate from that. So I remember the first time touching him and holding him and remembering like love just grabbing my heart and squeezing like I'd never felt that. And for me, it was such a great picture of divine love, that this is what God feels when he sees me. But I also remember feeling the weight of I am responsible for him. And what I believe was a moment of divine grace, I suddenly thought, I can't be Spencer's father, not the father that he needs, not the father with the power to guide and protect him. He needs much better than a father than I. He needs a heavenly father. And a relief kind of swept over me, realizing I can be his human father and I can do the best that I can in that role, but I cannot be God for him. I can represent in some ways, but I can't be God for him. And in the years to come, and I still do this, I do this prayer of release, and I do this for a lot of people, where I literally take my hands and say, God, they're yours. They're your children. You love them deeply. You intimately know how they're woven and what's going on in their insides and why they're making good decisions and why they're making bad decisions, and I'm going to help, and I'm going to truth tell to them, but they're ultimately yours. And I release them and give them over to you. And that burden for me was gone, because all of a sudden I could be free to be nothing more and nothing less than what I really was. Their earthly father, filled with love, but possessing only limited responsibility. That's what we do with people, all people, not just the kids, but there's this sense of, we give them over to you, we're going to do what we can in the time that we've been given, but ultimately they're yours, we can't control, so we give them over to you. It's probably what Paul meant in his spirituality, where he says, I've just learned to be content in whatever state I find myself. To be content with our limited humanity liberates you and I from trying to be God, from trying to strive for the impossible. And what happens is it makes possible this greater peace and joy, because you're not on the treadmill. You're not striving. You're not trying to control. You're not trying to deal with every situation. You're learning to let that go, and you're learning that sometimes you fail in your expectations, and people fail sometimes, or feel that you fail because they have expectations of you, and it's all good. It's okay. Let's end like this with this prayer. We could say it like this. Keep calm and say the serenity prayer. I mean, friends, think of this. It takes a great wisdom to know the difference between things that you can change and things that you cannot change. Last couple sentences. Most, think of this. I thought of this today. Most of the frustrations in our life rise up from our unwillingness to accept things that we should change. We kind of sit back and we just accept it, but no, we should change those, and our futile attempts to change the things we should accept. Most of the frustrations in life come from when we sit back and accept things that we should really change and bring about transformation, and then our futile attempts to try to change things that we have no power over. We harm ourselves and others when we fail to possess the wisdom to know the difference. And so let me say this to you, and then we'll say it together. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Learning to live one day at a time, picture Jesus, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as he did this sinful world, acceptance, as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. That's a fantastic prayer. That prayer should be ripped out about every 10 minutes, I'm imagining. It would save a lot of problems. Let's stand and say this together. And let this be our final prayer for this time. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as he did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will. May be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Amen.